the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the recording of our second Australian Aid Evaluation Forum for 2017, in partnership with DFAT's Office of Development Effectiveness. In this second part of the forum, panellists discuss an evaluation on pandemics and emerging infectious diseases in the context of an increasing focus on regional health security at DFAT.
Well, thank you very much. We might get started. I think we're only a few minutes late, but those who have just joined us, I'm Peter Vasija. I head up DFAT's Office of Development Effectiveness, and we're just about to start the session on the evaluation of a decade of Australian support to combat pandemics and emerging infectious diseases in Asia and the Pacific. And pandemics is one of those issues that sort of doesn't become an issue until it becomes an issue. And all of a sudden it's a mad media scrum, we're under existential threat and we're all going to die. So it's really, I think this evaluation is really quite timely because doing this sort of work in between the crises is so important in terms of improving our preparedness and our capacity to respond. I think the evaluation has some really important factual statements to set the evaluation in context. The first is that in 2013, the insurance industry cited the risk of a global pandemic as the greatest risk to their industry. I think the estimated annualised losses from a global pandemic is around $60 billion a year, totalling about $60 trillion for the rest of this century. So the economic costs, let alone the social costs, are quite staggering. And I think the other thing that the evaluation points out too is that not only is Asia a known epicentre for a global pandemic, scientists believe that there is a high likelihood of a new highly infectious animal-derived influenza will emerge in Asia over the next decade. So that's pretty sobering. So we've got some great presenters today to talk about the evaluation. First is Dr. Gil Scarahoot. Is that right? From the Kirby Institute. Gil led the evaluation, has been sort of the main technical manager of the work. We've also got Blair Excel, who's just been announced by the Minister as the new Ambassador for Regional Health Security. Blair, of course, has been working for DFAT and before that AusAid for many years and has the Regional Health Security Initiative under his leadership now. That'll be followed by some comments, first by Dr. Nicholas Coatsworth, who is from the Department of Infectious Disease at Canberra Hospital, also done a lot of field work with Medicine Sans Frontières. So I think, fair to say, coming with a field perspective on the evaluation. And we've also got Dr. Mohammed Patel from the ANU College of Medicine, Biology and Environment. Now, after the comments from Nick and Mohammed, we'll have a question and answer before we'll have some concluding remarks with the whole session from Dr. Jim Adams. I'm going to be fairly ruthless about time for my presenters because we are running a bit behind schedule. So I'd very much like to welcome Gil to the stadium podium.
Thanks very much, Peter. Can everyone hear me okay? I've had a bit of a cold, so I sound a bit more husky than I ordinarily do. And thank you for the scene setting for our evaluation and for your courageous efforts to pronounce my surname. All right, so I'm going to just perhaps start, if I may, by taking the opportunity to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today and to pay my own respects to the elders past and present. And I also would just like to introduce the other team members who are in the room today to start off with. We have Irene Wettenhall, who is our manager from ODE and an embedded team member with many years' experience in the aid programme. And we have Dr. Laurie Gleeson, who is our animal health systems specialist on the evaluation and who will be able to field any curvy questions you might have about the animal health side of the evaluation during the Q&A session. We also had on our team Adam Craig, an infectious disease epidemiologist with considerable work experience in the Pacific, who's not with us today. So I'm based at the Kirby Institute for Infections and Immunity at the University of New South Wales, I have worked in the field of public health evaluations for a number of years, for the first kind of half, I guess, of my working life in Africa, where I ran a research-based consulting, and we had a lot of contracts from different developing agencies evaluating large-scale programs, predominantly in HIV prevention. And then since 2009, I've been based in Australia and dividing my time between work in Aboriginal Australia, also in the field of evaluations and in primary healthcare systems, and doing work for the AID program as well, predominantly for health in health evaluations. But this is my first experience working with ODE, so it's been something new for me. I'd also just like to acknowledge David Slattery from ODE, who's provided some important strategic and editorial advice along the way, which is highly valued by the team. And of course, no evaluation is really complete without acknowledging the many people who gave up often many hours of their time in the countries that we visited for our fieldwork. Ministers of people in ministries of health and agriculture, and our partners in the development sector in the region, and of course DFAT Post in our fieldwork countries, who made our fieldwork run really smoothly and helped us to access the right people. So, how do I turn the slides? Oh, there we go. So they're often, it's quite a large evaluation. And for those of you who aren't aware, the evaluation report is now live on the DFAT website. So under ODE, you'll be able to find a copy of the full report, which is here. There are many things that could be said about it. And what I decided to do was really to structure the presentation around four main findings, which really form the basis of the recommendations that we have put forward for consideration by the AID program for future work in this area. I'm not going to read through them here, we'll go through each one of those. But there are obviously many other things we could talk about. I'm very happy to take questions and discussion during the Q&A session. And also just to say, if you have any specific quick questions of clarification as I go along, you're most welcome to interrupt me, as long as they're just short. So I guess although our evaluation was retrospective, as Peter mentioned, covering the last decade of Australia's support in emerging infectious diseases, the issue of health systems strengthening and whether or not these investments made under this these two strategies contributed to health system strengthening is a very topical area and very current. I think, as many of you will be aware, health systems in our region are facing many challenges. And for example, the Pacific Island countries and territories, a number of the countries have some of the worst maternal and child mortality outcomes in the world. And some of the populations in Southeast Asia really struggle to access, or face many barriers in accessing quality health services, cost barriers, and even quality of providers and mixed and fragmented health systems, which do not really provide a very good foundation for a coordinated response should we have a disease threat in the region. So I'm going to talk first about just a little bit about the evaluation scope and the methods that we used, and then run through some of these main findings, and then end with a brief summary of the recommendations. So there were two strategies which formed the kind of frame, I guess, for our evaluation. The Pandemic and Emerging Infectious Disease Strategy 2006 to 2010 was the first Emerging Infectious Disease Strategy, which was really developed by the then AusAid to help guide Australia's investment and response to the threat of avian influenza in those early years. And then that was lessons that strategy was reviewed, and the investments made under that strategy were reviewed and taken into account in development of the second strategy, which ran from 2010 to 2015, the Pandemic and Emerging Infectious Diseases Framework. And both of those frameworks shared the overall goal of contributing to stronger human and animal health systems to better prepare for, detect and respond to emerging infectious diseases. The second strategy included a bit more focus on community engagement and on gender issues, because these were considered to have been neglected in the first, or underemphasised in the first period. So under these two strategies, there was, around 194 million that was invested. So this was a subset of funds that the aid program contributed to health programs, around 4% of the total spend on health, so quite a smallish overall proportion. There were 35 investments that we included, but our evaluation focused on the 10 largest groups of investments, which accounted for around 82% of the total funding pool. I don't know if you picked up the some of the handouts that were at the front desk. If you did, there are a couple of supplementary slides at the back of these, which give you a bit of a sense of the range of modalities and implementing partners that implemented these different investments. And from an evaluation perspective, it was obviously, you know, quite challenging. We sort of considered different ways of how to deal with this diversity in modalities and in implementing partners and, of course, in localities. We took a place-based approach and a systems approach to the evaluation. We were not looking at each of the investments against whether or not they had achieved their individual objectives and targets. We were trying to step back from them and saying, okay, did these investments overall, taken together, the portfolio together, contribute to stronger health systems? When we went down into the field, we visited five countries, and we chose sites where there were a number of different investments that were implemented or should have been or could have been implemented in that area. And we looked at how those investments had worked together with one another, how they'd been complementary or, you know, or not, and how they had intersected with and worked with the country human and animal health systems that they were meant to be ultimately strengthening. So there's no generally sort of widely accepted means to measure health system strengthening or whether an investment has contributed to health system strengthening, but there is guidance that we can sort of glean from different pieces. So we started out looking at the literature and looking at the program documentation and past evaluations that had been done, and we decided to draw on the WHO building blocks framework, which the World Health Organization conceptualizes or describes the health system as comprising six building blocks, and we used those as a kind of starting point. And we also supplemented that with using the four key questions, which are contained in DFAT's Health for Development Strategy. And these are questions that were designed by the authors of the questions to help understand and unpack what differentiates health system strengthening from health system support. So, for example, you may go in and train 1,000 people and walk away again, and the argument is that that would be an example of a support at a particular crisis time. A strengthening intervention would actually make sure that training was embedded and able to be continued to roll out. So does the intervention help to strengthen the system longer term, or is it just a short-term support? So we kind of used those as the main touchstones, I suppose, to develop evaluative criteria across the portfolio. So we were focusing on the contribution to the overall goal of strengthening health systems. And we were guided from the TOR with a set of six evaluation questions. But each of them kind of came back in the end to health system strengthening. So the fieldwork, which I probably haven't mentioned and should, is the fieldwork commenced about a year ago. Just over a year ago when we started, we went across to Fiji, and we also went to Solomon Islands. And then we had a break, and then we did fieldwork in Southeast Asia, where we went to Thailand, to Bangkok, where we could just meet with our regional partners and discuss the regional programs in Southeast Asia, and then to Cambodia. And then in Indonesia, we spent some time in Jakarta, in Yogyakarta and South Sulawesi. So I'll just move on to the findings, given that we've got a timekeeper here. So this first slide refers predominantly to the human health sector, but has some crossover into animal health as well. So one of the most very clear overall findings was that certainly the last decade has seen improvements, clear improvements in the quality and the availability and timeliness of reporting about disease threats in our region, between different countries and within countries. A lot of people spoke about greater transparency between countries and a lot less defensiveness involved in talking about disease threats that they faced. There's also some evidence that's been published independently of our evaluation that documents faster recognition and reporting of outbreaks. So obviously the challenge of contribution, I'm happy to talk about further during the Q&A, but so the picture that we formed through the fieldwork and document review is that Australia's investments had made very definite contributions to this situation, and this came about through efforts on a number of fronts. And we talk about in the report the development of hard technical capacities, for example. Some of the investments funded long-term technical advisory positions within WHO country offices and also within country ministries of health, which really helped to build some really sort of hard sort of core skills in disease surveillance. And there was also support to field epidemiology training programs and an adapted form of field epidemiology training in the Pacific, which was really a cornerstone of effective disease surveillance. On the kind of soft capacity side, there was investment in and support to professional networks and providing countries with opportunities to share and build relationships, establish trust and to share information with one another. There was also support given to public health laboratories and to establishing rapid response teams in different countries. So not to sort of downplay those kind of substantial gains, it was also very clear that the use of data for planning and response has not actually kept pace with the availability of data and the increased capacity in surveillance. And this is obviously really important when it comes to infectious disease, because if you don't have timely rapid response, your surveillance is of kind of limited public health value. It obviously has value, but you're really not getting the full value out of that investment. And it was also clear when we looked at the implementation approaches that were used in the investments that in the human health sector, there was quite a strong focus, almost exclusive focus on technical and often vertically driven approaches, which were very effective in achieving this increased technical capacity, but were not able to really engage with and address some of the constraints at higher levels in the system. And I'm happy to provide some examples or talk about that further if we have time later on. So just turning briefly to some of the findings from the animal health system, moving to the investments in animal health. So I think what I didn't point out, but it was in the pie chart in the second slide that I showed, is that animal health investment comprised around 37% of the total portfolio. So it was a fairly large chunk with an additional, I think it was around 20% from memory, of investments targeting both animal and human together. So we jointly made investments. So it was a fairly large part of the portfolio, and it commenced during the time of heightened concern around avian influenza. So there was a lot of need for fast action, and it was quite expensive action because a lot of it was grassroots community development of community surveillance systems, for example, and reporting. So the money in animal that was directed to animal health systems was a lot of it was used to establish animal health surveillance systems and to train people to use those systems. There was also investment in developing partnerships and collaboration for disease control, and some money went to upgrading animal health or developing animal health laboratory capacity. And these investments met with varying degrees of success in terms of sustainability. Bearing in mind that the context for veterinary system, the context is that veterinary system development in the region is a lot weaker than the human health system and is quite weak in the Pacific compared to Southeast Asia. So, for example, in the Pacific, there was some work done to train para-veterinarians and to develop animal health laboratories made through an early investment under the first strategy. But there was very little evidence of a legacy of that we could see when we went to the Pacific, and this seemed to be largely because of a lack of foundational elements to build on, with the lesson being it's very hard to build entire systems from the ground up. But also, of course, that investment was made at a time when people really weren't sure what was going to happen with avian influenza. So there were two sort of standout examples, I guess, of system strengthening gains that I'd just like to draw your attention to. The one was the regional, the development of a regional disease control model for foot and mouth disease, established with support from Australia since 1997. So you might ask why foot and mouth disease is included in the portfolio, which is what I asked in the beginning. In fact, it was a really interesting, had a really strong influence in building a foundation for further zoonotic disease control. And the regional disease control model has been used as a basis for ASEAN disease control for avian influenza and for rabies. And the important part about it, or one of the success factors of why it has been successful, is because of its clear alignment with the economic drivers of veterinary system development in the region. Similarly, in Australia's bilateral investments in Indonesia supported an animal health surveillance system called ISICNIS, which is much broader than just animal health, but can be used for animal health and zoonotic disease surveillance. And this model, we also found in our fieldwork, had really achieved very good ownership by the government, with a lot of co-investment by the government of Indonesia, and strong ownership and engagement by all levels of the veterinary system in the areas that we visited in the pilot areas. So just a comment about One Health. So the One Health principle was also included as a part of the guidance under the strategies. So One Health, recognising that the health of humans and animals and the ecosystem are interconnected, really emphasises coordination and cross-sectional work, interdisciplinary work, to address disease risks that emerge at human-animal interfaces. What we found in the evaluation was there were a number of different approaches were tried to implement One Health approaches, but ultimately this was very difficult to operationalise. The maturity of the departments differed. Often public health, human health systems were a lot stronger than the veterinary health systems, and this created a bit of an imbalance. And the ability to collaborate and the willingness to collaborate between sectors varies quite considerably. There were some the opportunities where there were successes and where things seemed to be going well was when focus was around specific concrete areas such as rabies, something that both sectors could see their role and execute it. So we've also, how am I going for time? So just a couple more points. We also looked at community engagement, which was a particular focus under the second strategy. Different models were tried of community engagement, which we describe in the report. And although these were somewhat successful against their objectives at the time, there was a real challenge in institutionalising them. Some of the models that were piloted to engage communities in detecting emerging diseases or infectious diseases were too expensive to be sustained, or operated somewhat outside government structures and then weren't taken up when the pilot time of the period of implementation of the project ended. And there were also some engagement with communities achieved through government systems in Indonesia, through the PDSR, Participatory Disease Surveillance and Response System, which again was found, although successful in surveillance, was less successful in terms of response, and was also considered to be quite expensive to maintain. There were also different approaches to addressing the gender dimensions of emerging infectious diseases, but these tended to be, perhaps could be described as formative rather than, you know, really giving us a good model of how to do this better. Quite an interesting chart of the increasing female participation of Indonesia's field epidemiology training program over time, which was perhaps one of a really nice positive story. And there was also efforts to promote female participation in community development projects more generally. So we also considered monitoring and evaluation as one of the questions that we were asked to address, and looking at that again through the lens of health system strengthening, and did the M&E help to support the overall goal and help the investments to achieve their overall goal of contributing to strengthening health systems. We found there was very little attention to measuring performance in relation to the contribution to health system strengthening M&E frameworks. Even what you would kind of want to see would be a well-articulated theory of change that could describe how what you know we're doing in this investment was contributing to and intersecting with the health system overall, and this wasn't really in place at the time or in many of the frameworks, and even many of the evaluations didn't really address this as an issue. We also recognised and learned of the challenges for regional programmes in trying to understand their role in contributing to strengthening country systems, and often some of the regional programmes struggling with getting that country ownership and buy-in and you know, making a meaningful contribution in that area. There was some research funded under the portfolio, but there was none in the human health on the human health side. It was predominantly on the animal health side, some of it with some very good evidence of research uptake and influencing policy and programmes, but not all of it. So the recommendations that we have put forward for consideration to DFAT can be already kind of in five main areas. We really were left with the impression very strongly after looking across the portfolio and looking across the decade of investment that while what has been done to date has provided a very good foundation for future in terms of technical capacities, some of those technical capacities are still fragile, but to gain further progress and to gain public health value from this investment and to make further progress in surveillance and response capacity, there needs to be greater integration on the human health side of EID, emerging infectious disease work, with country health systems and with health programmes. Obviously, a different approach is needed. We describe a differentiated approach, recommended a differentiated approach between the Pacific and Southeast Asia. We also recommend perhaps greater targeting of investment in the area of animal health systems, recognising that there is a risk of unsustainability if we try to build systems from the ground up, which is just not possible to do. So to try to build where there is some foundational structure to build on. And also we recommend alignment with the economic drivers of veterinary system development, such as seen through investment in the FND regional disease control model. But also it's very important not to allow animal health issues to be sidelined under and get lost, given the with a strong focus on animal health production. The recommendation four is to do with efficiency of the programme, really looking at DFAT's management of these kind of investments, which are quite complex and in working in a complex space, and recognising that there are fewer dedicated health staff, particularly in Southeast Asia, and the need to understand what the requirements are for DFAT staff and upskilling if needed, to engage in dialogue in this area to make sure that the policy goal is achieved. And then finally, if DFAT is to be supporting research and have a research strategy around emerging infectious diseases, to ensure a systems approach, not a narrow vertical approach to this research, to include human health research in the portfolio and to ensure that research governance supports relevance and uptake of the research to the aid programme.
Bang on time. Thanks, Gil. That was actually pretty well timed. I'd like to call up Blair Excel now for his 10-minute talk.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Jill, for that great summary. Colleagues, thanks for the time and coming to join us here this afternoon. Let me also acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that we're meeting on and pay my respect to the elders past and present. DFAT greatly values the findings of this ODE evaluation. With the greatest respect, Peter and Jim and other members of the team, not always Do I say that? And I don't always say that and keep a straight face as well. So it's an even smaller subgroup, but this was a truly useful evaluation, timely. And the way it was also conducted from our perspective was incredibly useful. We talked to the team as they were going through the evaluation. We used the information as it was coming through. So it was of great asset to us. Not surprisingly, the reason is because the government announced last year a commitment to regional health security, and we are in the process, or have been in the process, of developing a new regional health security initiative to improve health and development outcomes in the Indo-Pacific through research and partnerships. So as Irene just said, it's a utilisation-heavy evaluation. It sounds like a very evaluation set of terms, but that was actually truly what it was. So that was great. The elements that we have been discussing pretty widely across Australia over the last 6 to 12 months are around an initiative that will accelerate health security research, establish collaborative global, regional and country-level partnerships, and build people-to-people and institutional links. And even those three headline components, you will see the overlap there with the findings from the evaluation. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about our direct response to the evaluation and talk also a bit about what we're looking to do in the coming period. So DFAT, let me just have up front, agrees with all the recommendations, apart from some slight qualifications in relation to recommendation two, and I'll talk a bit about that when that comes up. The first recommendation is focused on ensuring clear links between future emerging infectious diseases investments and health system strengthening is core to our approach. This fundamental principle has informed all of our health assistance policies since the development of the pandemics and emerging infectious diseases strategies that was covered in the evaluation itself. I think the first one was around 2006. Australia's current policy approach to regional health security builds on our the government's health for development strategy for the period 2015 to 2020. This strategy prioritises building resilient and sustainable human and animal health systems and strengthening regional preparedness for existing and emerging health threats, including the growing drug resistance in tuberculosis and malaria. For example, in the Pacific, DFAT's funding support for WHO on health security requires consideration of the health system implications for all country-level activities. We're also working closely with the Public Health Division of the Secretariat of the SPC to consider how our support aligns with countries' systems in their business plans. In countries where DFAT does not have significant bilateral health investments, we engage with key multilateral and regional partners with established country presence in health, as highlighted exactly in the recommendations. In Asia, for example, we're working closely with the World Bank to strengthen health systems and ensure they're sustainably managed and financed. This includes a focus on health security financing and system strengthening. Health security is first and foremost built on actions at the national level, but it's unrealistic to expect any one government or even the global community to be able to entirely prevent infectious threats from emerging and spreading across borders. While it may be a statement of the obvious, however, it's worth repeating, diseases do not respect national borders. Increased global connection and advances in travel mean that outbreaks cause social and economic impacts in affected countries across the region. This is why Australia is taking a regional approach to health security. We have a long and, I think, proud history of building the capacity of our neighbours to manage communicable diseases. We've done this through forward-looking policies, investing in critical regional initiatives, and advocating at regional and global level. We've already made major investments in the region, and this evaluation noted $194 million investments over the period that it looked at. And as well as programs and those financial investments, we also advocate at the political level to achieve regional health security. APLMA, the Asia Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance, is a great example of regional collaboration for a common goal. With Vietnam, Australia co-chaired APLMA at the East Asian Summit in 2015. The Prime Ministers of the two countries presented a roadmap for malaria elimination in the region by 2030, which gained the unanimous agreement of 19 heads of government. As part of APLMA's focus on combating drug resistance, a regional regulatory partnership has been formed to explore ways to increase the quality and efficiency of the approval processes for new and improved anti-malarials. A final example, and more recently, Australia has just agreed to co-chair the Alliance for Country Assessments for the Global Health Security and International Health Regulations. So we consider this a great opportunity to engage more closely in this important process, where the joint external evaluations coordinated by the WHO and the national action plans based on those findings will set the direction for strengthening countries' capacity to prevent, detect and respond to health emergencies. For the evaluation's second recommendation, which focused on how best to address animal health as a part of Australia's regional health security approach, we agree that any new investments in animal health surveillance in Southeast Asia should build on past experiences and lessons. We're pleased that the outcomes achieved in the region from our past investments have created a modest platform for response for future zoonotic disease emergencies. Recommendation 2 also provides specific direction on future investments, including continued support for FMD in Southeast Asia, and to limit future assistance for animal health in the Pacific to biosecurity and quarantine. While both of these aspects will be considered in the design of future animal health investments, decisions on specific investments will need to be considered against the current context, funding priorities and needs of our partner government. So that's a slight qualification that I referred to. DFAT fully supports recommendation 3, the focus on increasing attention to gender in the design of future investments. This is aligned to government's broader commitment to implementing through our overseas aid program, stronger equality outcomes. So we've undertaken to make better use of gender analysis to inform the design and implementation of the future regional health security investments. In response to recommendation 4, we're focusing on what skills we need, and we are taking steps to ensure we have those capabilities, including through the potential secondments from other agencies with specialised skills. The evaluation referred to maintaining a credible leadership role on health security in a region and with our whole-of-government partners. That is fundamental to DFAT's approach and is reflected in the first recent appointment by the Foreign Minister for Australia's first ambassador for regional health security, as Peter has already referred to. DFAT also agrees with Recommendation 5 on future emerging infectious disease research, including the focus on human health systems research, a broader research approach to emerging health threats, and strong governance arrangements to maximise research update. Health systems research will be a key aspect of DFAT's new regional health security investments, and we will take into account the findings of the evaluation in the design of a new research funding mechanism. So finally, I want to reiterate the value and timeliness of this ODA Commission evaluation. It provided useful recommendations to inform the development of a real initiative that's right here in front of us and hopefully announced soon, including identifying lessons learned from past investments. So let me take the opportunity to thank ODE, the evaluation team, Jill, Lawrence, Adam and Irene. Thanks, Jim, for the chairing of the committee and everyone involved in this process. Thanks very much.
Thanks, that, Blair. And while we're sharing the love, it's sometimes rare to get a counterparty manager who was so effusive about our evaluation, so it was great. Now I'd like to call on Dr. Nicholas Coatsworth just to provide a few comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter, and thanks to colleagues at the Development Policy Centre for the invitation to discuss this report with you today. And I'd like to also acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land and pay my respects to their elders past and present. My background, as Peter mentioned, is in clinical infectious diseases as well as medical, humanitarian aid and disaster response. And I guess my current interest and future interest, at least for the next few years, is global health diplomacy, policy and decision making at a national and supranational level. My overall observation of this report is the authors have delivered a commendable report from a very challenging evaluation. As Jill pointed out, it's actually very difficult to assess whether an EIDA program has actually achieved its aims, which in my mind are reducing morbidity and mortality from infectious disease, protecting Australia's own health security and also our national interest, which are three different linked and sometimes competing variables with the subsections of surveillance, laboratory capacity, leadership, government and response as the two, as the strategy and framework over the past 10 years focused on. And the difficulty lies because it's challenging to attribute benefit to a particular program. And really outcomes, I think, need to be better defined with predetermined indicators and metrics. And there needs to be a consistent post-program evaluation with appropriate longitudinal components. And if a first sort of reflection can be made, then those future programs and future investments, if there can be that sort of consistent evaluation tool, then I suspect that the role of Jill and colleagues would be rendered considerably easier in the future, and a better assessment of that effectiveness can be made. The author's statement initial statements establish the challenges in reviewing some of the documentation of the key investments, and that at least some of them, the documentation was actually described as weak. The authors have drawn some valuable conclusions, but that means that there remains an evidence gap of sorts between the implementation of the programs and any potential assessment of their effectiveness. So the major limitation from the methodological point of view would be then the reliability of the source data, firstly in the program documentation itself, but also I think in the semi-structured interview format, which was an important modality for this particular report. I think there's a lot of benefit to be had in seeking stakeholder perspectives after 10 years of activity, and you can get a holistic view of the potential effects of the investment. On the downside, the heavy recall bias that could be introduced and the multiplicity of other actors and investments that are being made, both at Australian level in terms of the rest of our health development aid program, but also at with other international and multilateral partnerships. And an example of this in the report was actually the reflections on, I think it was the ASEAN Plus 3 investment programs, which were initially thought to have limited effectiveness, but that changed over time. And that could well mean that program did have some delayed effects, but it also might mean that some other factors were impacting on the responses of the interviewees. So I think it would have been useful for me to have a slightly more detailed reflection on the methods and the results of those interviews, perhaps even as an annex or as an appendix, particularly given that with the breadth of the stakeholders that were actually interviewed, it was not always clear how different views might be accounted for, or whether indeed the views of recipient stakeholders were prioritised over those of donor views. What was that accounted for, or even whether differences actually existed upon those lines? But looking forward towards future investment, so I think I'm in agreement that the question lies in the title of the report, Are Health Systems Stronger? And the report does make it clear a number of programs and investments that did have positive outcomes. So rather than focus on those, I might look at two recommendations in particular that I feel that I can speak to, and that's recommendation one and recommendation four. With regard to recommendation one, which refers to future investments having a more clear articulation with country health systems strengthening, I'd just like to draw your attention to two important quotes within the report. The first one, the available documentation was not designed to report against contribution to health system strengthening, and I think we've already heard from Blair today that's going to change. There were no examples identified of good linkages between EID investment and Australia's health system strengthening program. So why out of 10 years of work and reading a 136-page report am I just going to focus on those two quotes? We've only got 10 minutes, but I think there's a useful analogy that I can draw there. And that is through my own work at Canberra Hospital. We've got a very skilled infection prevention and control service there, run by my nursing colleagues. They have very close links to ward staff. They provide a support service in the event of an infectious disease outbreak. They undertake surveillance and active case finding. Now, imagine for a moment in late 2014, a patient suffering from the Ebola virus actually arrives in Canberra Hospital, as Thomas Duncan did at Texas Presbyterian. It's highly likely that at Canberra Hospital there would only be a single generation of transmission and that any infected healthcare workers would ultimately survive their condition with the type of care we can offer. Now ask yourselves this question. Was there a single generation of transmission because we've got a really, really good infection prevention and control service, or is it because of the hospital system surrounding that service and the system that we work in today? And the answer is very clearly the latter. Our infection prevention and control service in causality terms is a necessary but not by itself sufficient mechanism of controlling infectious disease. So Jill and her colleagues draw the same conclusion, albeit on a larger scale. Whilst we can improve surveillance and national laboratories, we can train epidemiologists and the like, these initiatives will be limited by the health system in which they're located. And the report highlights the investments where development of an excellent surveillance system outstripped capacity of health systems to use that data. So in this way, it's perhaps appropriate that we only have 4% of our total health aid budget dedicated to health security. In another way, it's disturbing that this is one of the only apparent growth areas of our aid budget. Clearly, we will not make headway unless we grow the other 96% as well. The logical extension of the analogy I've provided is found within the report, with the authors observing the need for a stronger linkage between EID program investments and health system strengthening programs. But the question is, how do we actually do that? And I believe Muhammad's going to focus a little bit on policy frameworks, so I'll leave him to do that. The other way is to ensure capacity as donors to assess, to make decisions and evaluate investments in EIDs, which is recommendation 4. And that recommendation actually asked DFAT to identify the level of representation and skills to contribute to effective policy dialogue with implementing partners and partner governments. We can explore the potential outcomes of that sort of recommendation by considering the concept of global health diplomacy and what actually is a global health diplomat. Fortunately, we have one with us today. It's the case, as Alona Kickbush of the Graduate School in Geneva has observed, that there's broad political, social and economic implications of health issues that have brought diplomats closer to health and public health practitioners closer to foreign policy. The concept of global health diplomacy, as you're all aware, has gained traction since the turn of the century, not the least because of emerging infectious diseases, amongst other drivers. So essentially, recommendation 4 of this report poses the question to us, how does Australia do global health diplomacy? And a number of authors have advocated that global health diplomacy is very specific tradecraft within a foreign affairs department. Brown and colleagues in 2014 in Science and Diplomacy write, core competencies for the health attaché, which they call it, must include in-depth technical knowledge of public health issues as well as broad-based general skills in diplomacy. And Kickbush has made the same observation in the literature. But even more importantly, a recent report from the National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine into the future role of the US in global health recommends, and I quote, Congress should amend the Foreign Service Act to enable global health experts within Health and Human Services, and the State Department should create a global health career track. Now, clearly, we are moving down that path if we have an individual who meets that definition within this room. But the ambassador needs their own cadre of experienced professionals to oversee the investments, and I think the authors have drawn attention to this need in the report. Individuals that actually understand the foreign policy implications of investment decisions on an equal level to the public health implications. Moreover, the technical experience must exist beyond the domain of health security, understanding that, like our infection prevention control analogy, health security is only one component of global health diplomacy. So to conclude, I've mentioned that recommendation 4 has validity beyond DFAT. The Chief Medical Officer of Australia is our key representative to the World Health Assembly of the WHO, along with the Secretary of Health, along with the DFAT representative. So to what extent is an individual's experience in global health and diplomacy counted in the selection of our CMO? Does the Department of Health provide sufficient support to the CMO with a robust cadre of individuals who practice the tradecraft of global health diplomacy? Brown and colleagues point out that a number of health attachés sit within the US Department of Health and Human Services and not necessarily within the US Department of State, depending on their role. Do we have a clear view of the expertise in this domain between Barton and Woden? A 10-minute discussion does not do justice to the work that has been put into this evaluation. And as someone who's been at the front line of health responses in the region, I can say that it's very comforting to know that such an evaluation has taken place and that concrete recommendations such as these can underpin the next round of investment. I do want to conclude by reiterating the message that health security alone does not global health diplomacy make. And whilst there's an international tendency for donor governments to focus on the security aspects of health development, this has to be viewed as a small, albeit important, part of an integrated approach to global health diplomacy. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for that, Nick. I'll be quizzing Blair on his health qualifications very shortly. But I'd like to call Dr. Muhammad Patel to provide a few comments. You're here in person. I heard you were going to be on link.
I think the Development Policy Centre for inviting me to comment on the evaluation of the initiatives discussed earlier This is an area close to my heart. It's what I've been, what I spent the last 20 years doing here at the ANU, where we run the training program that Jill referred to, which is the field epidemiology training programs. But a lot of my work has been in the Asian region, helping establish or evaluate these type of training programs, and also working with the Pacific to establish that. I must say that the word training program is a misnomer. They're not training programs. They intended to be capacity building programs. And this is rather unfortunate that they've been evaluated as training ones, which they shouldn't be. Just a quick overview of the talk. I mean, this was a formidable task. Reading through that report and trying to work out what to present in 10 minutes was even harder. There are excellent aspects to the report, and I don't think I want to go in repeating any of those. And so I wanted to cherry pick a few things that I'm particularly interested in that I know reasonably well. I do just want to touch on the first issue of what I think was a mismatch between the purpose and methods of it. Then I want to comment on challenges, and some of these have been covered quite well by Jill. And I think despite those challenges, the conclusions and recommendations made are certainly very important and useful. And then this is a cherry picking where I just want to make some comments and considerations in the recommendations for a couple of issues. I really want to talk on something else, which is the current focus of my work, the unintended consequences that investments in regional health security and global health security could have on national health security. And I think people are forgetting that national health security for a poor country is very, very different from global or regional health security for rich countries. I have a declaration. Jill referred to the two strategy documents. I'm therefore not an independent evaluator here. In 2009, I was on the team that evaluated the previous strategy and then drafted the framework for the strategy 2010 to 2015. In addition, there were a range of projects commissioned through AusAid on which I worked on, so I'm very familiar with several of them. Among them includes developing and implementing and evaluating the field epidemiology training program in Vietnam. Another area close to my heart is the Pacific, and I will be talking a little about that as well. And I should declare that I have been working with the SPC and the Pacific Public Health Surveillance Network that is referred to in the report. So any comments I make should be treated with understanding my vested interests. Firstly, mismatch between purpose and methods. And I think that's been mentioned both indirectly by Nick and Jill has certainly covered it. But when I first read this, and it says to build the evidence base on how to strengthen systems, I was taken aback because the expectation for me was it's an impact evaluation to determine what works. Now, clearly, the methods, documentary reviews and interviews doesn't allow for that. And as Jill has already said, the effectiveness of individual activities were not assessed completely in the completion reports. And therefore, I'm still not very clear on what the evidence of effectiveness of what works is, particularly if those performance reports lacked robustness. And clearly, this fact would have limited quality assessment of what works. But what is very appropriate are the range of gaps that were identified through this process. I just want to touch on the challenges for evaluation. As I said, Jill has covered them, but I'm just taking a slightly different perspective for it. Identifying what works is really a very challenging process, as recognized by the evaluation team. Because with health systems, what you're talking about is you're taking a very complex intervention and inserting it into a very complex health system. Secondly, there's lack of consensus globally on what a health system is, how one defines it. and how to strengthen, implement, and evaluate a health system. And this is the reason I was so cynical. The focus was on health system strengthening. How on earth are they going to try and make some sense of it? I must say, I was quite impressed by the approaches used to come to the conclusions. And I think Jill's past experience in evaluation reflects quite well on that. The third factor that's relevant is that in these interventions, there are multiple actors within country, from different countries, with different perspectives and interventions on each of the building blocks referred to. So it's really a mess. And that is why you can understand in the literature why health system strengthening has been labeled as a laundry list, a black box, even a black hole or a bottomless pit. It's just a nightmare trying to evaluate it. We currently have a student doing his PhD on this subject in Indonesia who's in the audience here, and he is terrified with health systems and what, and in particular, what health system strengthening is doing to other elements of it, and therefore my discussion about what are the unintended effects that countries have to bear from this effort. And I want to just move on to what works. And again, I'm picking on this example because I have familiarity with this through some other hats. And I agree that it's an exemplary model. I've talked with Mike Nunn, who's also in this audience, who's worked with the Department of Agriculture and who currently is based at DFAT's research arm in animal health in Asia. And he tells me that in this process, I mean, this is a 20-year steady capacity-building initiative. What was of greatest interest to me was how staff from state, territory, and Commonwealth departments in Australia are actively engaged in the region. The vets in the region are their mates. They meet with them every day. How exciting. So therefore, for consideration, to me the question is, could this model strengthen regional initiatives in human health? There is no such arrangement for opportunities of health staff to make friends with people in Asia, with health department of people working in health departments to establish the type of relationship needed to develop trust and collaborations. Now, research is a very important agenda item, and I think, you know, is this a case for research to generate an evidence base on effective regional mechanisms of working with people in Asia and the Pacific? The other single example I want to pick out, as I said, there are lots of points I could have done, but within 10 minutes, there's only so much. What Jill highlighted was the gaps in surveillance, and more importantly, in transforming intelligence into effective actions, policies, and programs. Now, I know this area well because I've worked with FETP here in the training program in Australia and in the region. And Jill attributed this to lack of attention to policy and organizational constraints and lack of development of explicit strategies to strengthen broader health systems. I wasn't quite clear whether this reflected a problem with the way the program or projects were designed or in the way they were implemented. I would tend to agree with this, but for consideration, I'm just suggesting something different. Integrating regional health security strengthening systems with the broader general health system strengthening are an absolute nightmare, as people in the Global Fund might say, and I'm sure Jill has that experience of how do you integrate HIV surveillance with general surveillance. Lots been written on it, and nobody really has an answer to that. The added problem is going to be, as we all know, the SDGs. The current Director General of WHO has placed universal health care as his priority. Are we then going to have universal health care and then regional health security as another vertical program and broad-based health security as yet another program? I think there's lots of questions about how this is done. What interested me in the report is that there's a suggestion that there was some success in integrating these systems in Indonesia and the Solomon Islands, if I understood this correctly. If this is true, then to me, is this another opportunity to generate an evidence base on how to make these two work together? I just want to touch on another point, which is my current area of research interest. One of the evaluation questions was, did the initiatives address different risks and drivers of EIDs in Asia and the Pacific? I think it was addressed in part. I have another particular interest. In the literature, the upstream drivers originating in rich countries are not being addressed by the power base. And these are the economic and trade policies and strategies. And the example of Ebola is a classic example which shows the biases of the major medical journals. If you read what explains Ebola failures, it's a health system, health system, health system. Blame the technical people. Really, the problem is the economy and trade policies which bankrupt those countries. The professional health workers leave because there is no earnings there. They'd rather work in the richer countries because there's a safer income and better educational opportunities for their children. So these are conveniently being ignored. Talk global health security, talk about protecting the rich from those nasty things that come from the poor. And these are well reflected in the literature in the big journals. Otterson's excellent article on political determinants are not being addressed. And Kickbush, global health crisis is not primarily one of disease, but of governance. And governance refers in this context to what are rich countries doing to act on those higher level determinants of disease, not only of infectious disease, but applying equally to the non-communicable diseases, which is all about commercial determinants of disease and marketing strategies. So for consideration, how could the new regional health security contribute to addressing the higher level ones? I think the UK is attempting to do this. The UK has adopted what they call their national global health policy. To my knowledge, Australia doesn't have a national global health policy. And among the items in the global health policy in the UK is a statement that we will work out how we contribute to nasties in the poor world and see how we can address those. Similar statements have been made by other countries such as Switzerland, Norway, Germany. So is it time Australia develops a national global health security that provides a framework for regional health security that is sensitive to the needs and priorities of the poor countries? I want to touch on this topic on recommendations. As I said, for the Pacific, they have enormous challenges on small island states, and Australia has enormous leverage in the Pacific as compared with what they can do in Asia. For consideration, there are three issues that were not touched in that report, but I think they are worth considering. There were three concurrent epidemics of arboviruses in the Pacific in the last few years: dengue, chikungunya, Zika. Everyone's probably familiar with Zika virus causing the nasty disease and congenital abnormalities in Brazil. In the Pacific, more than 12,000 cases were reported with Zika virus, and I'm not familiar if specific funding was given for those initiatives or whether SPC and WHO found alternative sources to try and contain the disease. What's even more interesting and worrying is that studies of the genetics of the virus are now revealing that the outbreak in Brazil was probably imported there by a team of canoers from French Polynesia. So the Pacific may not be a hotbed for emerging diseases, as stated in the report, but it may be the amplifying grounds for spreading things around the world. I come to this other point: high investment in EID, could it divert attention and resources away from the NCD crisis in the Pacific? Ian Anderson, who's in this audience, based at the Crawford, has done work to show what the budgetary cost for Pacific Island countries are to manage non-communicable diseases. If I'm correct, Ian, I think you said something like 80% of some of the budget of these countries are going to health care. Now, if that money goes there, should they prioritize regional health security and say, oh, no, our priority is infectious diseases. We must do what our donors tell us. Limited number of resources, limited health workers who wear the one hat. The person doing communicable diseases also does non-communicable diseases, climate change, maternal child health. Where should they spend their time? Regional health security, IHR core capacities, or NCDs? The third one I was interested, the report said, still unclear what the right model for public health workforce development in the Pacific would look like. The SPC has designed a plan. It's called Strengthening Health Interventions in the Pacific in 2013. I was one of the co-authors of that plan. We had an epidemiologist from the European training program who then visited the Indian Island Ocean countries who have a program, and we used those adaptations to propose something for the Pacific which was last year already approved by the health ministers. I didn't see any reference to this report. As I said, I have a biased interest on this topic. My last slide, regional health security conflicts with national health security. What is national health security, and in particular for a poor country? It's when people and states are prepared for, protected from, and resilient in the face of health threats. It's not only about EIDs. Regional health security is about EIDs, not other things which spread across borders. For those familiar with NCDs, NCDs is now being called a socially transmitted disease, or some people say a commercially transmitted disease across borders. What are we going to do about that security for the Pacific? In the literature, it's increasing now that lower and middle income countries have expressed concern that the current framing of global health security, the IHR, that's what it's all about, prioritizes investments in EIDs over other threats. There's a concern that these strategies could divert attention and resources from other needs. The other needs refers here to children dying from acute respiratory infections or diarrheal diseases that are not an EID, that are nothing to do with the IHR. My consideration, how could the new regional health security think about national health security for poor countries, or is it all only about the concerns of rich countries? Thank you.
You went way over time, but I didn't care. That was great. Thank you very much. And thank also to Nick. There are really two terrific responses to the presentations and the evaluation itself. Can I ask if Mohammed, Nick, Blair and Gil could come to the sort of the TEDx type arrangement here? We've got a bit of time for questions and answers. Can I have a show of hands? Who wants to ask a question? Come on, don't be shy. Hey, Prue.
Thinking about, you know, how bold the evaluation was in making recommendations and going out and doing that. I wanted to commend you for doing that, because, you know, so often we get evaluations that have like 18 recommendations, which are kind of so vague and so timid that, you know, they're really not very helpful. So, I think it was... great that, you know, these robust recommendations were made. Just on the question of whether it's possible to evaluate their impact and so on, I think it's interesting that of the, you know, the whole new joint external evaluation process that's now being rolled out by WHO, which is a combination of the old international health regulations method of assessment and the global health security assessment. So 30 of these have been done now in different countries, including four Mekong countries. And it's three Mekong countries. And Just recently, our colleague from World Bank did a very quick kind of snapshot summary of what has been coming out of those evaluations. And interestingly, it is to find that the highest capacity was in surveillance and labs. So, I mean, I think it's no coincidence that you know, our programs through APSED regionally, through some of our bilateral programs, and that the US as well was working intensively on surveillance and labs in Asia. And so I guess it may be hard to attribute whether it's our program, or the US's program, or WHO, which both the US and us contributed to. But I think there is, you know, I think you're right in saying that there was, there were improvements overall. It seems when you look at these JEEs, and they're quite, they have got indicators, so there have been improvements in those areas. Yeah, so that was one thing. And secondly, I just wanted to thank Dr. Patel for his comments, because I think the potential for distortion is, you know, recognised by all of us who've worked in vertical disease programs before. And I think that's something, you know, we need to watch out for, and there are possibly ways we can try and address that. Thank you.
Before I go to the panel, is there other questions? Thank you. Stephen.
If I may, I'd probably be raising this tomorrow, but the question I had really stemmed from the recommendations. The report does talk extensively about the significance of community engagement in terms of addressing outbreaks and prevention in terms of both human and animal disease. And I think it's very valuable in terms of what it says there. But I know it's always difficult in terms of recommendations. I was expecting we might see something in terms of community engagement. There is that valuable section you have on the lessons that you have appended, and there's some instructive guidance there. But to me, community engagement is a very, very important part of where the focus should be, and I'm surprised it didn't find its way into an actual formal recommendation.
Okay, I'm going to go to the panel now. I think the team leader might have to field some of this.
Shall I start?
Please.
Is there a microphone?
Is that...
Well, perhaps I'll just start with that comment from you, Stephen, about community engagement. Other team members might want to contribute as well, but I guess the real... we were bold in the recommendations, and perhaps it might have been too bold given to make a clear recommendation about how to further strengthen community engagement, because it seemed to us that there wasn't really a clear model that came out that was really appropriate in both an outbreak emergency setting and in the kind of peacetime setting. So, I guess it was more that we're still learning what works, and that, that's still a challenge. So I guess from my perspective, we couldn't really give a clear recommendation about it. I don't know if Irene would like to comment on that.
Well, I'd just add that perhaps that's an area where some of the research funding under the new Regional Health Security Initiative could be directed.
Any comments on Prue's?
Don't know if there was a specific question, sure. Prue.
It was a fair little comment. Oh. Fair enough. Oh, sorry, Stephen.
Thank you, Peter. I just thought to put Blair on the spot and get him to respond to the discussants, and in particular, Nick's question, does DFAT have the expertise in global health policy? And Mohammed's point, you know, seems to be to the link to health system strengthening. I mean, do we really know, is there any evidence that can actually be done by any aid program?
Yeah, I was taking lots of notes through both those presentations that were fantastic, so thanks to the panel. So
On the first one around health capability or capacity, let me first of all acknowledge Principal Sector Specialist Stephanie Williams, who's been with the department for a couple of months now, 3 months, who has actually got a great background and area of expertise in this, so that's a real boon to our team. But my broader answer is it's not just about DFAT here. As I was explaining to Nick, I think, just before the session started, we actually work extremely closely with the Department of Health, so in particular in this area, the Office of Health Protection, but then also far more broadly, the International Division in the Department of Health on a range of issues in this space. We also work with ACR, AG. In fact, we met with the Chief Veterinary Officer a few weeks ago when we were talking about the new program coming up. So I think in regards to the health diplomacy agenda, in no way, I think, should it be seen as just a Department of Foreign Affairs agenda. It is actually a whole of government approach. We're very actively looking at greater engagement with those departments in whatever comes forward through the new initiative. So I think that's important. There is internal aspects, certainly of DFAT, where it's ongoing work, and I think we pick that up in our managed response to the evaluation about what we're doing to support, protect and build our own internal capability. But I think I would just draw... let me point to the example, I think, of evidence here of the response to Ebola. When it came out, I co-chaired with my counterpart in the Department of Health Australia's Ebola response. Myself very much looking at the international engagement, the range of things that covered. There was a debate in the Security Council, a range of other aspects, and then Department of Health leading on domestic, and the Chief Medical Officer, Chris Bagley, at that time, engaging all the WHO reference groups. There was an internal evaluation, actually, that came out that we did that across the government, came out. Actually said it was one of the very rare, one of the only few experiences where it was co-chaired by two departments, such a major response, and certainly one of the ones that worked so well. So we saw that as a really positive experience, and that's certainly the model that will go forward in this broad agenda. In terms of Mohammed's question, so really, I'm not sure I've got the easy answer. In fact, I'm sure you could probably tell me much more than I could tell you. So that is the great, in one sense, debate that we're having around getting the right balance between a health security around emerging infectious diseases and maintaining a mix on health systems. There's been 30 years of literature on health systems and how to get a better focus, and I think from WHO down, how to make this work better. In my experience, I have actually seen greater attention, if you like, to health systems through a slightly more political, slightly more topical agenda of health security, and I think that's a positive, and that's an overlap that we are really actively thinking about, how we can find the sweet spot between these two areas, not trying to overemphasise one. There's still, at the global level, continues to be, in fact, the recent World Health Assembly in June, continues to be friction on this overall topic. Some of that was geopolitical between countries and the US. Some of that was I think, legitimate concern. So there is still issues going on, and I think a process through the regional committees of WHO to bring together a new, if you like, overarching approach to global health security and IHRs. But I note also that there was a clear, I think there were six, maybe 16 reviews of WHO's response to the Ebola effort and how to do better. And so the emergency program of the WHO is a real kind of global response to messages about Ebola in that case, but the much broader issue of emerging infectious diseases. A much more positive response in DRC recently that actually went quite well. Greater than expected appetite for global involvement in a country level issue for WHO, which was great. There was a sort of recent feedback to us from WHO in the last sort of month when they look at how it's going post Ebola. So I think there is potential to have a win, you know, a positive experience from this, and that's certainly the approach that we are taking through the new regional health security initiative. But certainly don't want to kid that it's an easy thing or we'll get it absolutely spot on right. I think we have to keep working on that balance.
Okay, thanks, Blake. Nick, you wanted to say a few words?
Sort of elaborate a little bit on Blair's comments there. That sort of chaired interdepartmental committee model in at least some ways stemmed from Australia's health response to some other disasters, including Typhoon Haiyan, cyclones Winston and Pam, of which I was a part of in my role in the National Critical Care and Trauma Response Centre in Darwin. So it does actually work very effectively in those disaster sort of situations. But I think in sort of policy development terms, that's called a punctuated equilibrium model, where you have these sort of crises and we do it well. And in fact, having seen other nations do it, we engaged with the Japanese team in Typhoon Haiyan, who were astonished that our Department of Foreign Affairs and Department of Health actually spoke to each other. So I think we do have quite a mature response in that sense. But equally, it's about the sustainability of that response over time and having a clear understanding, presumably under the aegis of a policy framework that is a whole-of-government one, as Health is Global was in the UK. I'm not sure. I think that was dumped by David Cameron. I'm not sure what they've got now in the UK. But that is a whole-of-government framework to assess the effectiveness of global health interventions across government.
Thank you. Mr. Callum.
I find this all very interesting. Thanks very much for the presentations. I mean, I find it an interesting part because I hesitate to say this. I was one of the authors of the 2006 strategy. And of course, a long time ago, a lot of the authors have since then. I guess I would like to just reiterate one of the points that you made just now, which is about the value of interdepartmental coordination, consultation on orders. We found that absolutely invaluable back in 2006, and I'm sure nothing has changed since then. Also, in putting the strategy together, this was a little bit of a comment, and to give you an idea, we had to deal with not just the animal health perspectives of aspects and the human health aspects, but also the short, the medium, and the long term, and we had to deal with protection, prevention, and response, and we had to work as a global, regional, bilateral, the national level. So, I mean, once you've got all of those variables in there, you come up with a huge matrix, and it is very difficult to make any sort of proper sense. My point is not really about the complexity of all of that and how that is, but it was to make a much simpler point, which was that we really needed to take into account what other people were doing. That was crucial because we knew that Australia's contribution would be small, and they'd certainly be small in the Asian context, of course, a little bit bigger in the Pacific context. And just apropos of that, I'm not sure if your reports cover this, but can you give us any sense of the proportion of Australia's investment in terms of the overall investment in particular in Asia? Because I suspect it was really very, very small, even though it sounds like a lot of money, only $94 million over 10 years. 2-3%? I mean, let's be honest about this. It looked like a significant investment, and we wanted to essentially buy credibility, like another aspect in our dialogue with other countries, with our players, with our partners. But actually, in overall resource terms, it was a kind of.
Peter, I have to take that on notice, sorry. Yeah. I'm not aware of the relativity, for example, of the 194 versus the total push on this. I think the US sort of global health security agenda was started much later than I think the initial phrase. So that was certainly a surge, again, to which our contributions are smaller in comparison. Mm-hmm. But I can't give you a quick figure, sorry.
Well, thank you very much. The time's now at an S.
So I just want to make one other comment. I didn't mean to miss, but Mohammed also referred to, I think, the issue. I think you call it a global health strategy or a national health strategy.
National global
health strategy, yeah. So interested to have a look at that from our perspective. I mean, in part, what you're talking about, I would say, perhaps, Steve, is our overarching policy framework that does try and look at the combination of countries' economic trajectory, the policies that affect that, constraints, barriers, et cetera, and think about where is the best place for Australia to support. So I think there's still room. Australia always needs to be look at areas of comparative advantage, areas of strength of influence and engagement and results. So even with that overall ambition, you may still end up investing in some narrower areas of that than the total picture, simply because this, we don't have the scope or breadth to do it. But certainly we'll have a look at that and think about what the implications of that are.
Okay. Thanks, Blair. Laurie,
yeah,
what's so
good? I just want to make it just a very quick observation.
Please.
I was just to say that it's very, very rare in such a context that an animal health kind of approach to things would be held up as something that might be a model that the rest of the system could follow. So I'd just like to thank you for that endorsement for the way the vets do things.
Thanks, Laurie. That's we're about out of time. I'll leave some time for Jim to make some concluding remarks. But can I get people to thank Jill, Blair, Nick, Mohammed, and Laurie? I'll just call Jim to come and make a few closing remarks.
Yes, we'll make them short and hopefully focused. IEC has been operating for 5 years now. And one of the things we were asked to do is do a little thinking about some of the issues and some of the benefits of IEC. And I have to say, on the benefit side, today we've had a nice manifestation of what I think are the two best practices that have emerged in the context of the broader evaluation program for the aid program in Australia over the last 5 years. First of all, this practice. I don't know of any other example where civil society, development society, gets together with its respective development agency and has a discussion like this. As Steve has said, this has been a regular thing. I have to compliment ANU because they've certainly been prepared to put in the time to do this. I have to compliment the people that come to participate. We always have had very good participation of people interested in the topics. And of course, ODE has been prepared to subject its work to this. I think it's produced better work. I think it produces a better feedback between the community and ODE. So I really do think it's a best practice. I think the second best practice I'd focus on is now what's emerged as a much stronger interaction between the strategic evaluations of ODE and the operational evaluations done by the different parts within DFAT. We've had a nice example of that today with the discussion of the education project. I think that gives a robustness to the evaluation process. I think they focus on very different issues, but together I think they give a much stronger evaluation focus than in most development agencies. A couple of issues, and again, they both emerged today. The first is data. We're constantly harassing from the IEC side. And in both discussions today, I think the question of robustness broadly, of what's happening in the health sector, in the education discussion, it was much more focused. The data had to be created. I think this reveals weaknesses not just in DFAT's work, but indeed in overall development work. I'm constantly frustrated by the fact that when you look at the social sectors and the data in social sectors at the macro level, which will provide important baseload work for analysis, the simple factor is if you look at the Pacific, much like when I worked in Africa, you know, half the data points are not there, and even when you drill down on the data that is there, it's not very good. I think this is a failure of the development community. And I always contrast to what happened with macro data. 60 years ago, the IMF decided macro data was important. And while they'll concede all sorts of weaknesses in their data sets are full. And when you look at social sectors, you look at education, health, data today remains a mess in most low-income countries. And it makes it a lot harder to give any sort of evaluation of the interventions, and particularly if you want to move from outputs to outcomes, it makes it extremely difficult. I think we've looked a lot at the micro data that's done at the project level. And again, I must say, we're often critical of that in IEC because we find very often evaluations go out and they can't find the data that was supposed to be there. And again, it results in a weaker evaluation at that level. The second thing that I want to focus on is it was mentioned value for money. We're constantly harassing the ODE team on improving value for money. I have a particular concern that sometimes on the analytic side, when good rate of return analysis can be done, there seems to be less attraction to that in, in DFAT than my experience in the World Bank. But I think, again, better work in both of those areas would ensure better evaluation. Finally, just a comment. I think we had a nice example today of where there was some learning going on. I think we have an ambassador that came and was prepared to endorse a set of recommendations, which now everyone in this room can hold DFAT responsible to. We always talk about, you know, the importance of learning in evaluation. I do think this is a nice example of that. It doesn't always happen the way we'd like it to happen. And I think it's one of the areas we'd like to continue to work on with IEC to make sure that when important lessons are learned, those are disseminated. One of the things that ODE does do every year now is it reviews its former recommendations and goes back to management with a clear message. So while, you know, while Peter talked about the formal reports that are done, I simply want to emphasize that a lot of other things that are going on internally, which we feel ensure both a stronger evaluation system and a stronger impact of the evaluation on the broader work of DFAT. So I want to close just by thanking everyone for coming, and again, a particular appreciation for ANU and the Development Policy Center's efforts to make sure these sessions are sustained. Thank you.
Before you race out, I have a couple of final messages from the sponsors. First, I'd like to thank you, Jim, for wrapping this up so nicely. I'd also like to thank all of the presenters today for making this such an interesting and engaging event. Thank you all for coming along, for devoting your time and providing your input. I also need to provide you with a bit of an infomercial, I guess, an advertisement. For those of you who have not yet had enough development in your day today, I need to inform you that the Development Policy Centre is holding another session being held in this room starting at 5:30 p.m. And it's a talk by Alice Albright about funding for global education. So if you want more, please stick around. Please come along to that event. A couple of final thank yous too. I'd like to thank the Office for Development Effectiveness, Office of Development Effectiveness, for being such a good ongoing partner in this event. And I'd particularly like to thank Tanya Pradanikoff for being working so well with us in the lead up to this event too. So thank you very much, Tanya. And finally, I'd like to thank you, the audience, for sticking around and staying engaged. See you all in six months' time at the next event. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.